3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. We are, I don't know, I feel like I say this every week, but really rocketing through the year. It is already the 26th of February, which seems extremely far into February for my liking. And we have a massive show for you today. So I might get started with taking you through what we've got on. Starting off, we've got Narita Waite, CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, who joins us to talk about how Victoria's tough on crime agenda is exacerbating systemic failures in duty of care to Aboriginal people in custody. Now, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service put out a really distressing media release earlier this week that showed the effects on one of their clients, Nathan, a proud Gunai Kurnai man, who has been effectively shuffled around between Victoria police stations and was in such a dire situation that the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service actually went to the Supreme Court to seek an injunction before he was ultimately moved by Victoria Police into a corrections facility. So after that, we're going to be joined by Dr. Anita Munoz, who is the chair of RACGP Victoria, the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. And Dr. Munoz joins us to speak about the groundbreaking impact of the enablement of GPs in Victoria to diagnose and provide primary health care to people with ADHD in the state, and how this will really reshape and positively impact the access to holistic healthcare for people with ADHD. After that, we are joined by Prosper Australia's Executive Director, Raina Fahey, who unpacks Victoria's windfall gains tax, which is a state government taxation measure that's applied to land that significantly increased in value because of rezoning. Now, this comes in response to a statement put out earlier this week by the Property Council of Victoria, which is urging the Victorian government to abolish the windfall gains tax and making arguments that this is going to greatly increase state productivity. But of course, we will demystify that with Raina. And after that, we are going to listen back to a clip of 3CR's Done by Law from last month, where Human Rights Law Centre Director Sarah Schwartz joined presenters Marissa and Beth to unpack findings from the federal court case, Brown versus Assistant Commissioner of Police. And we'll hear a bit about the three challenges brought by Human Rights Law Centre on behalf of their clients, Tarni and Onus Brown, Benny Zabel and David Hack, and about the ultimate ruling that Victoria Police's declaration of the entire Melbourne CBD for 6 months was unlawful and invalid. And finally, last but not least, we are joined by Mitchell Price, who's a PhD researcher at Monash University's Emerging Technologies Research Lab. And Mitchell's joining us to speak about the growth of the data center industry in Victoria and the potential impacts of this industry in the wake of the Allan government's fast-tracking of approval for a $1 billion data center at Port Melbourne over this summer. Now, this is something that I'm really excited to talk about because the data center industry is emerging in so-called Australia, but it's also quite established in other parts of the world. And I'm keen to hear from Mitchell about the sorts of implications that the growth of this industry will have here. So make sure that you stay tuned to 3CR 855 AM. We are with you on Thursday Breakfast all the way through till 8:30 in the morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Tune in for a special broadcast on March the 5th, 2 p.m. for Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day 2026. This year, we will be continuing our conversations on dissociation and complex trauma with the theme of navigating medical systems. Dissociative disorders and complex trauma are highly stigmatized in society, and seeking professional help is no exception. Join me, Amy Ciara, and other people living with dissociative disorders and complex trauma, and our stories of what it's like navigating medical systems. That's right here on 3CR Community Radio, March the 5th, 2 p.m.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
This is Thursday Breakfast and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM. This is Leela and I'm in the studio with Priya this morning. And after you've heard about what we are going to bring you today, we are going to update you with this week's news headlines for Thursday, the 26th of February. The United Nations Security Council this week condemned escalating attacks on civilians and aid workers in Sudan, including the ongoing systematic killing and mass displacement of people in Darfur and Kordofan states. The Rapid Support Forces, RSF, carried out a major raid in Misteria in North Darfur state earlier this week, killing at least 28 people and injuring 39. The Security Council denounced repeated RSF drone attacks on non-combatants, civilian facilities and humanitarian aid workers, including multiple attacks disrupting the World Food Programme's delivery of vital emergency aid. The Security Council has this week imposed new sanctions on senior RSF figures, including travel restrictions and asset freezes.
Also in news this week, humanitarian groups have petitioned the Israeli Supreme Court seeking an urgent injunction to block an Israeli government order that would halt all aid operations in Gaza and the occupied West Bank from the 1st of March. Palestinians in Gaza say the ban will have immediate and devastating consequences for people currently forced by Israel to largely rely on aid for food, healthcare, and shelter amid Israel's ongoing occupation and genocide. Amid an escalating wave of state-backed violence in the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers and settlers this week conducted a number of separate attacks on Palestinians, injuring many in the Hebron area. Unlike for the Rapid Support Forces in Sudan, the United Nations Security Council has announced no sanctions on Israeli officials.
In other news, activists held protests in Geelong and Nam yesterday, targeting Defence Minister Richard Marles and Thai Airways over the export and transport of F-35 fighter jet components linked to Israel's ongoing genocidal attacks in Gaza. In Geelong, protesters occupied Marles' electorate office, with several locking themselves to equipment and displaying posters and banners demanding an end to export permits for weapons and weapons parts. In Nam, demonstrators handed out leaflets and unfurled banners at Tullamarine Airport during a Thai Airways check-in. Based on freedom of information requests and an investigation by Declassified Australia, it has been revealed that Thai Airways has shipped F-35 parts from Sydney to Israel via Bangkok at least 71 times since the current Israeli assault on Gaza began in October 2023. The activists accused the Albanese government and Thai Airways of secrecy and attempts to avoid oversight of shipment of military parts, actions which amount to breaches of international law.
And finally, in headlines this week, Digital Rights Watch has warned that the federal government is repeating the failures of RoboDebt after reports of inaccurate and harmful aged care assessments affecting older people across so-called Australia. The Federal Department of Health, Disability and Ageing uses an assessment tool that relies on automated classifications that human assessors cannot override, leaving many elderly people without access to essential care. Advocates have criticised the Albanese government for allowing automated decision-making to determine well-being outcomes, calling for strict safeguards to ensure final decisions are made by qualified humans rather than computer systems. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 26th of February, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same.
I'm sick of the little boxes. Aren't you too? Do you want to live in nourishing green neighborhoods where we share and care for one another and our precious planet? Are you sick of greedy people gatekeeping better futures from the rest of us? Then listen to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence every fortnight on a Friday at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR with myself, Amy, and the wonderful people taking back their cities.
And they all look just the same.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filè.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR, 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio File.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR, 855 AM. It is 7:15 in the morning on the 26th of February, and I'm now joined by Narita Waite, CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, who's speaking with us about how Victoria's tough on crime agenda is exacerbating systemic failures in duty of care to Aboriginal people in custody. The Allan Labor government's regressive bail law reforms have resulted in rising numbers of uncharged people being shuttled between police stations in Victoria, with particularly dire consequences for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are already subjected to systemic racism and intense targeting by police. In a media release published this Tuesday, Vals described the ordeal of their client Nathan, a proud Gunai Kurnai man who was subjected to abhorrent treatment and conditions in Victoria Police custody, leading to the service seeking an emergency injunction in the Supreme Court to demand a life-saving transfer. Good morning, Narita.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, I understand that Val's Custody Notification System, or CNS, was a vital outcome of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And since October 2019, Victoria Police have been legally required to contact the CNS when an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person is taken into custody. Can you talk a bit about how this system works and its vital function?
Yes. In 2019, Val's was successful in our advocacy to make it a legislative requirement for police to notify the relevant Aboriginal legal service when an Aboriginal person is taken into custody. The establishment of the custody notification system has been critical in being able to provide non-legal support to our community at a time when they are extremely vulnerable. The CNS is staffed by a team of custody service officers, and they support mobbing custody with things like wellbeing checks, advocacy to Victoria Police on behalf of a client, linking mob in with pre-interview legal advice, calling support networks or family members to advise if they're in custody, and also assisting with referrals to support services. As you can imagine, the CNS is there for 24 hours a day and 7 day a week service. And that means that they have to be across 333 police stations in Victoria. And it is truly a life-saving operation and a crucial service that we provide at VAL. And CNSs have been working nationally. And a lot of them have been linked to the formation of Aboriginal Legal Service. For example, for VAL, we've had a form of the CNS operating since that. The very beginning of our service. But this grew and grew over time, and then making sure there was legislative requirement was really important, because even at those ad hoc arrangements, we found that police just weren't great at kind of engaging with our CNS officers. And you can understand that when they're bringing particular issues to light and the pressure that can often eventuate through that. What we have seen, though, is that this service is under more and more demand day by day. The clients are far more complex, and it can be really, really difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, having that legislative requirement is so important, but as you've mentioned, there is an increasing demand, and since the passing of this suite of regressive bail reforms in Victoria over the past year or so, Vals has been sounding the alarm about the dire circumstances for mob who are already facing systemic discrimination and disproportionate targeting by police. Now, can you tell us about your client Nathan's story and what his story might signal about the welfare of other mob in custody in Victoria?
And I want to preface this by saying that I'm sure Nathan's story may cause distress to some listeners, and I also want to acknowledge that Nathan's story isn't unique right now. There are many Nathans who are sitting in police cells. Nathan, though, is a proud Gadai Kurnai man who over the last few weeks has experienced some abhorrent conditions and treatment in police cells, which led to significant concern for his welfare. He was in police custody for 26 days. He's unsentenced and yet to be found guilty of the charges he's in custody for. And we've been aware of a common Victoria police practice where they've been transferring people in their custody between stations to extend the length of time they can legally hold someone in police cells, which is about 14 days. So essentially, say, transporting somebody from Sale down to Moorabbin once they've hit that 14 days to reset the clock. Nathan alleges that the police cells that he's been held in are overcrowded, unsanitary, lacking in privacy, and restricts his ability for phone calls with his family. Nathan also experienced significant medical issues requiring 5 ambulance attendances and 4 hospitalizations during those 26 days. He was denied prescribed medication and a withdrawal pack to manage symptoms and was told he would only get access once he's transferred to a correctional facility. I'm sure anybody on the face of hearing that can understand that this is inhumane and breaches basic human rights. Therefore, Val sought an emergency injunction in the Supreme Court late last week, seeking an urgent transfer for Nathan to be moved from police custody to a correctional facility so he could receive the medical support that he required. And also so that those other things I talked to you about in terms of that he wouldn't be in an overcrowded cell, he wouldn't be in unsanitary conditions. He'd have a modicum of privacy, but he would also be able to connect with his family, who are a protective factor for Nathan. Now, whilst Nathan has now been transferred to a correctional facility, people do continue to be impacted by this dangerous practice, putting their well-being, safety, health, and ultimately their lives at risk. And I think this is something even the police union, despite pushing for the bail laws that have put us in this situation, acknowledge that a death in custody is an inevitability at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it is just a horrifying situation that you've described. And, you know, our thoughts are with Nathan and his family, but also with all of the people who are subjected to this and, you know, may not have even been able to access, legal representation or support to raise their voices about this. You know, as you said, he's not the only one. And I do wonder what this means for the ability of Aboriginal legal services and the custody notification system to keep track of mob in custody and actually, you know, provide them the support that they need if they're being transferred around.
And I mean, like, this is part of the problem in terms of the way the system works, right? Because they introduce these regressive reforms. They don't put enough in then the downstream impacts to manage the capacity, and then you end up in a situation where people's human rights are being breached, but where you also risk people dying in custody. And we know that, you know, for example, Vals has really struggled to receive the funding that it requires to support people to apply for bail, but also for those downstream matters, because the state says, oh, sorry, we don't have it. But again, this means that people are sitting in incredibly vulnerable positions. And, you know, in Nathan's instance, our custodification service made over 200 calls to him while he was in police custody, as we knew he was in a dangerously vulnerable position. Throughout those 26 days that he was in police custody, Victoria Police disrespected the role of our CNOs, making it known they didn't actually see the value in this legislative requirement. On several occasions, Nathan and Vals were questioned and rushed through those critical welfare checks, leaving Nathan to feel unworthy of any modicum of care. And in Victoria, so much police behaviour remains unchecked and without accountability. And allowing this practice of what police refer to as decanting, which is the transfer between cells, despite improper design and resources in police cells. And these are not safe places to detain people for prolonged periods of time, particularly those with complex mental health and medical needs like Nathan. And like I said, Nathan is not the only client in this situation. Vals has been calling for independent police oversight in the form of the police ombudsman with a resource to investigate complaints from aboriginal people for so long. And yet still this remains unaddressed. And I think if anything can be learnt from what has felt like a never-ending cycle of making small wins in making sure that the justice system has a modicum of fairness and then seeing that overturned is that history repeats. And therefore, we need ongoing accountability and meaningful reform to try one day see the future where the justice system is fair and equitable, where the presumption of innocence is not just a term, it's something that's actually realised.
Yeah, I mean, that is such a powerful summary of what's at stake here. And I do want to emphasize again for listeners that Nathan is unsentenced. This is, you know, people are being held before they've been charged, before they've been sentenced in these just inhumane conditions. And you know, just to wrap up, in the lead up to this year's state elections in Victoria, you know, given that the Allan Labor government has been openly signalling its enthusiasm about a tough on crime approach, what concerns does Vals have, and what should people be paying attention to?
Look, I think both the major political parties, Labor and the Liberals, an absolute disappointment when it comes to justice policy, and that's keeping in the nicest of terms. What I think is important is that when we consider the use of independents and parties like the Greens and the Animal Justice Party and Legalised Cannabis, who have really fought to ensure a fair and equitable justice system, it's important that we have those voices in Parliament. It's important that they are able to hold governments to account. But I think what I would like to see is our society really push for, let's have a meaningful conversation on what does community safety actually mean? Does it mean what governments have reduced it to, which is let's forego the presumption of innocence, let's just lock our problems away and pretend they don't exist because that's going to make us all feel better? Is that community safety, or is community safety let's tackle the things that are driving crime, let's tackle poverty, let's tackle homelessness, let's tackle what is a really disparate and under-resourced health sector, and particularly mental health and disability, because when I look at my numbers day in, day out, that pops up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
That, to me, would be a good first step. But I have yet to find a government brave enough to do that. If you do find me one, let me know.
Look, you know, we can't just wait in hope. This is, as you said, all of our responsibility to keep the pressure on and demand the change that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and the rest of everyone else in Victoria also really, you know, deserves for a better future and a new vision of community safety. Thank you so much, Narita, for your time this morning.
Not a problem. Have a lovely day.
You too. And that was Narita Waite, CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, speaking with us about how Victoria's tough on crime agenda is exacerbating systemic failures in duty of care to Aboriginal people in custody. Now, this interview did include some distressing themes, and if Mob want to speak to anyone about this, you can call 13YARN on 139276, or you can call Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. It's 7:29 in the morning, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Salam Radio Show on 3CR Community Radio is a show exploring the intersection between music, art, culture and storytelling from the Swana region, its diaspora and beyond. The show is dedicated to platforming emerging artists and showcasing new and traditional music, often with cultural, historical and political significance. Tune in every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 3CR Community Radio to listen to Salam Radio Show with your host Marushti. I'll be playing some mazika and having important and interesting conversations in between.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:32 in the morning, and we are now joined by Dr. Anita Munoz, the chair of RACGP Victoria, the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, to speak with us about the vital and life-saving impact of ADHD care for of access to ADHD care by primary practitioners and the importance of a recent expansion of diagnosis and care provision for holistic care in general practice. Good morning, Dr. Munoz.
Good morning.
So I wanted to ask you about what has recently changed in terms of access to ADHD diagnosis and care provision, and how, you know, this is sort of something that we've seen happen across various states and territories. So what has changed recently?
So the first thing to say is that these changes are going to occur in September mm-hmm. of this year. And so what we're doing is preparing for those changes to take place. And essentially what that means is legislation will be changing such that GPs are now going to be able to continue to prescribe ADHD medication with fewer regulatory issues that they have to manage. So, for example, there is a permit system that GPs have to apply for to prescribe the medications, and every 2 years the patients who are being collaboratively managed by GPs have to return to a non-GP specialist to receive permission to keep treating. Those things have caused bottlenecking in the system. So that is one of the meaningful changes that's going to happen in terms of reducing regulatory red tape in general practice. But the second and probably the most newsworthy change that will take place in September is that GPs who undertake appropriate training will now also be able to do the ADHD assessment and initiate medication independent of non-GP specialists. And this change is intended to be for patients who are suitable for the general practice landscape. So by no means do I expect that GPs will be independently treating people with very complex needs or, you know, a lot of other complex comorbidities, for example. But certainly there are many, many patients in the community who are suitable for management in general practice. And if we can deploy the general practice workforce, then we're actually leaving more appointments by paediatricians and psychiatrists, for example, to take on more complex care, and that's going to lead to a more equitable landscape across the state for everyone.
Yeah, and I mean, thinking about the way that this is bottlenecked, I'm also considering the, you know, the burden and wait lists for people who are seeking ADHD care and support and have to wait for a psychiatrist to become available. What kind of impacts do you think this will have on, you know, the general accessibility of this kind of care for people who need support to manage ADHD in the everyday but don't have those complex comorbidities?
Yeah, so we know that at the moment, because there are very, very few public services that treat ADHD, it has essentially become a branch of medicine that is almost exclusively treated in the private sector. And now that means that if people don't have the funds to pay for private services, then they're essentially missing out altogether on diagnosis and treatment for ADHD. So this means that there will be a more level playing field in terms of accessibility, but also the spread of services geographically across the state. We're always concerned that a lot of services are concentrated in metropolitan areas, and we have adults and children in regional and rural parts of Victoria that miss out because of that geographical disparity. So certainly it will mean that there are services evenly distributed across the state. But also I certainly hope that the cost of achieving a diagnosis and getting treatment and having ongoing care will be reduced. I do believe that delivering ADHD care is unlikely to be done totally bulk billed, because the assessments that we do in ADHD are necessarily very long, and often people need to have two or three long appointments before the diagnosis can be made and medication can be safely started. And so, as we all know, the MBS, our Medicare benefit schedule, really pays less and less and less the longer time you spend with a patient. So in the general practice sector, I can't imagine that all of the services would be totally bulk billed, but I do expect that compared to what people are paying now, it would be a significantly more affordable to have this care delivered.
Yeah, it does seem like a significant equity concern there in terms of being able to access appropriate care. And, you know, we know that primary care providers, general practitioners, are involved in taking care of a lot of people's health needs. It's sort of, you know, a one-stop shop for people to begin to figure out, you know, what's ailing them, to access treatment and referrals for a variety of different things. So how do you see this increased capability from September fitting into holistic care for patients?
Well, in my mind, it makes total sense, because a general practitioner, and this is the thing about being a generalist, is that a general practitioner does necessarily wrap their mind around all of the comorbidities that a person is experiencing. We treat all of the body systems, and we do that from preconception right up until death. And so a GP is in the perfect position to understand not only the condition that they're treating, which is the ADHD, but all of the other conditions that the person is also living with. And they understand the psychosocial situation that that person is living in. And so in terms of being able to understand the holistic needs of a patient, that is the very definition of general practice. So I think that this is very well suited to our profession. Having said that, I also recognise that there's a really good opportunity for our state to look at changing its framework for ADHD holistically from a health service point of view. So we do need more public health services at a specialist level. We do need psychiatrist trainees to be seeing ADHD patients during their training. We do need private services that can treat more complex patients without needing to pay the fees in the private sector all the time. And we also want to have really solid frameworks for collaborative care when GPs and psychiatrists or paediatricians need to work together to meet the needs of more complex patients and also meet the needs of the ongoing education of both GPs and the non-GP specialists together. So if we can establish a good health service frameworks underneath this change of legislation, then we really could be delivering meaningful change in terms of access for ADHD patients in Victoria.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking to that, you know, lifelong learning, as it were, and process of really embedding a recognition and understanding of ADHD and neurodivergence into medical training more generally, into psychiatric training, and then making sure that there are easily accessible pathways for integrated care support seems to be a really important way forward. Now, Dr. Munoz, just towards wrapping up, I wanted to ask about what this pathway to accreditation for general practitioners might look like, and what are some things that you're hoping will be put in place by the Victorian government to ensure that this this all goes to plan and provides the best possible care for people living with ADHD in Victoria?
So we already have some educational offerings and modules in place that we are ready to deploy, and that will be education for the GPs who want to continue collaborating with non-GP specialists but not necessarily do the assessments themselves and initiate medication themselves. For the GPs who want to become independent in terms of assessment and medication initiation, we are in the process of designing some very well-structured workshops and also webinars to meet the needs of our rural colleagues that will be extensive in terms of talking about the approach to adult and then separately also paediatric patients, to make sure that GPs have a really good understanding of the approach to diagnosis, managing the comorbidities, considering the safety of medications and the ongoing surveillance and care of people who are using medications into the long term. So we are designing that education, and we have drawn together a really very motivated group of subject matter experts who will be creating those workshops so that we can deliver on time for September. We have a lot of GPs already reaching out to our college expressing interest. So there's no doubt that a lot of GPs around Victoria recognise the need and are more than willing to help serve their communities once they've completed their training.
Well, it's great to know that there is, you know, an appetite for taking up this training. And I can imagine that the development of these materials is a very challenging, but hopefully will be a very rewarding process once these changes are rolled out from September. Look, Dr. Munoz, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Anita Munoz, the chair of RACGP Victoria, the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, speaking about upcoming, potentially life-changing changes to ADHD management and diagnosis in Victoria with a new accreditation pathway and changes to the system coming from September 2026. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:44 in the morning.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:45 in the morning. And just a quick weather check. Today, we are expecting a high of 25 degrees in Narm, becoming cloudy. And currently, it is sitting at about 13.5 degrees, but apparently it feels like 13. We are now joined by Raina Fahey, who is Prosper Australia's Executive Director. And Raina is speaking with us about Victoria's Windfall Gains Tax, which is a state government taxation measure applied to land that significantly increased in value due to rezoning. Don't worry, we will unpack that with Raina if that is all sounding a little bit technical. But earlier this week, the Property Council of Victoria put out a media statement and report urging the Victorian government to abolish the windfall gains tax, claiming that it, quote, kills projects and deters investment, end quote. But as we'll hear from Raina, that's not the whole story. Good morning, Raina.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, just to begin with, can you please take us through how Victoria's windfall gains tax works in lay terms? Who does it apply to and what's it intended to achieve?
Yeah, sure. So a windfall gains tax recognises that sometimes the government does things and makes decisions that improve the value of a piece of land significantly, and that is called a windfall. If you're a landowner and the government rezones your land and it's worth $1 million and now it's worth $10 million, that's pretty exciting for you, but that's not actually something that you've done. So it's fair that you should share some of that gain with the community because it's the community that's created that value. So in Victoria, we have a rezoning windfall gains tax, which means that when the government rezones land from one use type to another, so from farming zone to residential, for example, then you pay part of the value of that rezoning back to the government.
Yes.
That's a very progressive piece of taxation, and a lot of other states are looking at what Victoria's done and gone, oh, that's a good idea, we should probably follow suit. But, of course, the Property Council doesn't share that view.
Yes, of course. And this week they've put out a statement, an accompanying report that the Property Council claims demonstrates the restrictive impacts of the windfall gains tax on things like access to home ownership for Victorians. Is this true? What is the reality behind the trade-offs that they've presented in that report?
Well, no, it's not true, because what it does is it restricts the amount of profit that people who are flipping land from one type to another are able to take. We did some research. This legislation came out of a response to the Fisherman's Bend development, which I'm sure listeners will remember, which was the largest urban development renewal project in Australian history. There was no rezoning windfall gains tax legislation in place at the time. And we did some research and looked at that and how much the value of land actually went up. And it was 368% across the sample that we looked at, which was before any development took place. So that's not just, I built a house, therefore it's more valuable. It's the actual rezoning and the planning permission part of that process, which is where that great amount of value is being created. So we want to encourage people to be building housing. Absolutely. We need more houses in Melbourne, but we need people to be making profit out of building houses, not just those golden tentic decisions around rezoning.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that this incentivizes things like land banking, which I would also appreciate you unpacking, because, you know, if people are able to get those gains off just the rezoning or the improvement of the area by government, why would they build more housing?
Yeah, exactly. And what it does is it encourages, that sort of land banking, and particularly on the edge of the city. And one of the things that the Property Council has been talking about, and subsequently the Liberal Party have put out their housing policy over the last couple of days, and they're really encouraging that edge of the city development. And that just means more sprawl. You're putting houses where there is no infrastructure in place right now. But 3CR listeners might be familiar with another piece of research that we do around speculative vacancies, where we look at the number of empty houses that already exist there are in Melbourne. And there's over 100,000 empty or underused homes in Melbourne. And that also includes empty pieces of land. So there's undeveloped land already zoned for the residential that we would rather see developed. You know, empty blocks. Everyone's got one in their suburb, that giant empty block that's next to the train station, next to the hospital, next to the primary school, that we should be putting houses there, not 50 kilometres out of the CBD.
Yeah, hopefully that also demystifies why we see these blocks sitting empty. I mean, it's not always for the same reason, but, you know, holding on to those pieces of land without doing anything with them is also part of a strategy of land banking. Now, I wanted to ask about how Victoria's residential real estate market would change if the windfall gains tax was to be abolished, as has been recommended by the Property Council of Victoria, and how would it affect our already highly unequal housing system?
Well, it'll make the profits go up. I mean, if you get down to the economics of it, the windfall gains taxation is purely eating into the profits of developers. And we can understand why they don't like that. I mean, fair enough. And we want people to be able to keep profit from genuine productive activity. But speculative activity is really harmful in our economy. So we want to try and minimise that as much as we can. We would rather see the windfall gains tax get strengthened rather than abolished.
Mm.
It does have some key flaws at the moment.
Yeah, well, actually, can you go into that? What would you like to see strengthened?
At the moment, one thing that's excluded from the windfall gains tax is residential to residential rezoning. So it only applies when you're changing from one type to another. So farmland to residential or industrial to residential. But at the moment, if the government announces that you can do a lot more with your already residentially zoned land. So if you go from the activity centre rezoning at the moment is a case in point.
Mm.
The government says you can go from building a 2-storey house to building a 20-storey house. Or apartment block, it's probably not a house. Your property is overnight worth an extremely large amount of money more, but that's excluded. So that when the government says that you can do something more with your land, that is a gift. That is a gift of value because it's a property right that the government's giving to you. So it's absolutely fair that you should pay a price for that.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely fair that the wider community should benefit from that as well, because there is a cost to having increased development, but there should be wider benefits, and those benefits shouldn't just flow to the individual property owners, they should be flowing to the wider community.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that really frustrates me about pushes for densification that are also pushing for deregulation and, you know, trying to supposedly incentivize further development. But what is actually being incentivized is speculation, as you've talked about. So then the question, you know, remains: what will the benefit be to the broader community? How will this redress inequality in our housing system? I guess finally, I wanted to ask you, Raina, about whether you sense any indication from government that abolishing the windfall tax could be a possible course of action. You've mentioned that the Liberal Party's come out with its approach to this, and we are in an election year. So, what are you seeing here?
Oh, I'd be very surprised if Labor went back on their windfall gains tax legislation. I mean, it's a really groundbreaking piece of legislation. Other states are looking at it. It's bringing in a reasonable amount of revenue for the state, and it's helping transition what we would advocate is transitioning away from taxes on work to taxes on wealth. We want to be encouraging productive activity in our community. We want building, we want development, and we want to reduce taxes on that activity. We want to, you know, we want Victoria to be vibrant. And, yeah, there's, I don't think there's any way that Labor's going to go back on it. I'm hoping that the Liberal Party itself isn't going back on it. Their housing policy, they didn't explicitly state that they were going to get rid of that tax or make any changes to it. So we'll wait to see what their taxation policies look like, probably closer to the election. But the Property Council coming out and leading the way on the conversation is obviously putting pressure on them. So we'll see what happens.
Yes, well, hopefully they take a more holistic view of what kind of impacts this would have.
Because one of the things that we do know in Victoria is that the combination of taxes that we've got now on housing is showing really great numbers in things like first-time owners numbers. Victoria is the place to be if you want to buy a house. And all the other states are continuing to skyrocket up, but ours are not. And it's largely down to the tax system because investor numbers are finally starting to really drop here. And like, we want people to be investing in building houses, but we don't want people just buying houses that already exist and renting them to people because that just makes prices go up.
Yeah. I mean, look, I could talk to you for ages about this. I'm not so secretly a housing researcher myself, but it is definitely something to watch and to think critically about for all of our listeners. You know, it really does depend on which source you're looking at to see whether a sluggish property market or investors leaving the market is actually completely doom and gloom, or whether there's another way to kind of understand how Victoria's property market is you know, performing relative to other states and territories and what that might mean for, you know, changing dynamics of home ownership that aren't just one landlord buying up a ton of different properties.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you so much,
Raina. When an investor leaves the state, they don't take the house with them. Just remember that.
That is very true. All right. Well, really appreciate your time and hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Yeah, I'd love that. Have a great day.
You too. And that was Prosper Australia's Executive Director, Raina Fahey, who was unpacking Victoria's windfall gains tax. And earlier this week, the Property Council of Victoria put out a media statement and report that urged the Victorian government to abolish this tax, claiming that it kills projects and deters investment. But as we've just heard, that's not quite the whole story. And you are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. It is just coming up to 7:58 in the morning. And if you're just tuning in, earlier on the show, we heard from Narita Waite, CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, who spoke with us about Victoria's tough-on-crime agenda and how this has exacerbated systemic failures in duty of care to Aboriginal people in custody. And then we also heard from Dr. Anita Munoz from the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners Victoria about some upcoming changes to ADHD provision of care and accreditation to conduct assessments by primary care practitioners, which could really significantly change accessibility and also just income inequality in access of care for Victorians. I already said you're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast, but you know what? Why don't I say it again? You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we'll be back with you shortly.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! 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 This is Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:01 in the morning. Now, for our next segment, a replay of last month's Done by Law show. Now, on Done by Law on the 26th of January, Human Rights Law Centre Director Sarah Schwartz joined presenters Marissa and Beth to unpack the findings from the federal court case Brown versus Assistant Commissioner of Police. In this segment, you'll hear Sarah Schwartz detail the three challenges brought by HRLC on behalf of their clients, Tyneen Onus Brown, Benny Zabel and David Hack. The court ruled that Victoria Police's declaration of the entire Melbourne CBD for 6 months from November last year was unlawful and invalid. And this win called into question the legality of all other designated areas in Victoria over the last 6 months and the thousands of police searches that have taken place under these declarations. Now, if you want more background on this case, you can visit our episode from the 22nd of January by going to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. And you can also catch Done by Law on air every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. Here is Marissa, Beth and Sarah Schwartz.
If we zoom into the specific case that you brought, it was what were the legal arguments that you made in relation to the statutory powers that the police, you say, didn't use properly?
Yeah, so there were a number of different grounds in the case. I mean, I think it can probably be separated into three main sort of arguments. The first being that the designated area that was announced and declared in November 2025 was unlawful and invalid, that it was invalid because there was a misapplication of the statutory criteria. They didn't meet the statutory criteria. We brought another number of other grounds under that argument, that it was made for an improper purpose, for example, that it was unreasonable. Ultimately, the court found that grounds one and two were made out, that that Victoria Police had this excessively broad understanding of the statutory guardrails. It really came down to this, in the statutory criteria, there is an element that police have to be satisfied that there is specific weapons-related offending that is going to occur in this area, and that the designation is necessary to address that that weapons-related offending, and that it's the shortest time possible necessary to designate the area, and the smallest place possible. And I think we saw, you know, a very different criteria being applied by police. Instead, they considered what was appropriate to declare. You know, the assistant commissioner who made this declaration gave evidence that he considered whether a designated area should be declared. He sought that evidence be gathered on the topic. He then reviewed the general crime statistics that were handed to him and made the designation, but didn't consider that requirement of necessity. And so that was sort of one of the main arguments that we made. And so the court found with us on that point. And the second, I guess, group of arguments was that there was a breach of the charter and that they didn't properly consider human rights. Again, the court found that the assistant commissioner, that there was a breach of human rights under the charter and that the assistant commissioner didn't properly consider human rights. Part of that analysis was that there was no consideration of the right to privacy. So the power under designated areas, there's obviously this search power, which can interfere with people's right to privacy, but also this requirement to remove a face covering, which, you know, the court discussed that a person's face is the primary way in which they're identified in interpersonal reactions. And within designated areas, we have this intrusion where someone is either required to remove or either requested to remove their face covering or leave the designated area, which is the entire CBD. It's not a small demand to leave the entire CBD. And there was no consideration of that limitation to the right to privacy. So that it was unlawful on that basis. So that was sort of the second bit of the argument. And then the final bit was a constitutional argument that we made, which was the part of the case that we lost on. So we argued that the specific power of police in designated areas to request people to remove face coverings or leave the designated area, that specific power interfered and was inconsistent with the constitutional implied freedom of political communication. But because the court had found on the other grounds that there was this high standard of necessity that the decision maker did need to look to, for example, whether there are alternative measures to making a designation, because the decision maker has to consider human rights, because the individual police officers need to consider human rights when they're asking a person to remove a face covering, and because they're only meant to require or request the removal of a face covering when they're satisfied of certain criteria, that all meant that there was, that on balance, the constitutional implied freedom, it didn't fall afoul of the constitutional implied freedom, that it was constitutional, that power.
There are other designated areas in the declaration in November last year, not just the CBD. What are the implications of this decision on those other designated areas?
So that's a really good question because there are questions about the legality of those designated areas. So since this declaration, my understanding is that there have been 19 other declarations for designated areas, seven of those using the same power that the court considered in this instance. And I should say there are the Victoria Police have other powers when it comes to event-specific powers. This necessity requirement and these strict criteria apply most clearly for the sort of designations that allow for 6 month designations. But we have seen, you know, in various shopping centres around the country, 3 month designations. There are real question marks now over the legality of those designations and whether they should also be revoked. So I haven't spoken about, but we added a plaintiff and sort of just before the hearing in this case, a person called David Hack, who was on his way to a Palestine rally in the city and was searched under these powers. And his search was likely unlawful because it was under this broader unlawful designation. And so there are real questions to be asked about the legality of the hundreds of searches or powers that have been exercised in the city under these powers and for when it was in place between November and January. But there's also questions about the legality of many other searches and powers that have been exercised in other designated areas if police have been similarly using this equally broad, you know, overly broad understanding of their powers under this scheme.
And when you say questions over it, would it take other cases? What would be the effect for people on the ground if police continue to police as they have been before?
So, I mean, I hope that this means that police aren't exercising their powers as they have before, because, I mean, I think one of the things which became very clear in this case, for any of us who have been following how police have been using these powers at protests, you know, we have heard from people attending protests that police aren't necessarily wanding everyone before they do pat down searches or more invasive searches, that they haven't necessarily been, you know, that they've been requesting the removal of face coverings for people who are wearing face coverings for health and safety reasons, even if someone presents that as a reasonable excuse to them. And so all of these things, I think, raise questions about, yeah, the case really sets out how police should be using these powers. And so it should lead to police changes in decision-making. But I think that's probably where our sector comes in, the CLC sector, in really holding police to account now that we have this case law, and thinking about ways in which we can ensure that our clients also, you know, that these powers are exercised lawfully, and where they're not exercised lawfully, that we hold police to account in the exercise of these powers, you know, whether that means taking on other cases or complaints. But I think that this sort of sets a precedent, hopefully, for the sector to be able to use to hold police to account when they're exercising these powers, because it seems to me the police have been sort of exercising these powers really contrary to law for quite a long period of time.
You just heard a segment from last month's Done by Law show, where Human Rights Law Centre Director Sarah Schwartz joined presenters Marissa and Beth to unpack some updates from the federal court case Brown versus Assistant Commissioner of Police. In that segment, you heard Sarah detail the three challenges brought by HRLC on behalf of their clients, Tarneen Onus Brown, Benny Zabel and David Hack. And if you want more information and background on that case, you can revisit the Thursday Breakfast episode from the 22nd of January by going to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:11 in the morning. And now for our final interview for today, we are joined by Mitchell Price, a PhD researcher at Monash University's Emerging Technologies Research Lab. And we're going to be speaking about the growth of the data center industry in Victoria and the potential impacts of this industry in the wake of the Allan government fast-tracking the approval of a $1 billion data center project at Port Melbourne this summer. The Allan government has been open about its ambition to ruthlessly attract data center investment, raising questions about the place of regulatory protections and public consultation when weighing up the industry's impacts. Mitchell's research focuses on the growing data center industry in Australia and examines its social, economic, and environmental consequences. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks very much for coming in. All right. This is an easy one for you, a hard one for me, but something that I've been very interested to get a proper answer on. What is a data center? How do they work?
That is a great question, and one that maybe we're not fully across. We're hearing about data centers all the time, but pretty much data centers are the physical infrastructure which makes today's internet possible. Anytime you send an email or watch something on Netflix or listen to a song or access something from the cloud, that information comes from somewhere physical. You know, the cloud has connotations of being nebulous and immaterial, but actually it comes from these massive warehouses, which are called data centers. When you go inside a data center, it's essentially a massive warehouse full of aisles and aisles of cabinets, which are composed of many computers. And these computers are what you ping to send and retrieve information. So data centers themselves are incredibly energy hungry and also water hungry. So when, you know, you use your laptop for a long period of time and it kind of gets hot on your lap, that process is amplified thousands of times when you have a room with high densities of these servers, which are heating up. And that's also why you need water as well to cool them down in the form of like water pipes, which directly cool the chips, or air conditioning, which uses evaporative cooling.
Okay, that is a super, super helpful explanation. I think also starts to foreshadow some of the consequences that we can anticipate about the growth of the industry here and about how it's been operating elsewhere. Now, Victoria's been champing at the bit to attract investment from international tech companies, and this fast-tracked approval of the Port Melbourne data center is a striking example of this. Can you talk about the economic imperatives combined with the tech optimism that is at play in the Allan government's bid to host more AI and cloud storage capabilities in the physical form of data centers?
Yes. So over the past year, we've seen significant pushes by the Victorian government as well as Australia more broadly to try their best to bring a lot of big tech investment into Australia. So Australia is actually the country with the second highest amount of investment into data centers and AI infrastructure, just behind the US, which is quite striking. And the reasons for this is because they want to paint it as Australia having access to a lot of land compared to other more, you know, densely packed urban environments, and also abundant renewable energy. And it's also framed geopolitically as, oh, Australia is a more stable place to build your data centers, especially when you're dealing with sensitive information. And what we're seeing is a big push to bring data centers into Victoria by streamlining their application processes. So typically it takes sometimes hundreds of days for a large industrial development to be approved. And we're seeing with data centers here, that is being cut in half. And a lot of the typical kind of precautions and regulations are being streamlined because this is deemed critical infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, I want to ask you about that streamlining, because the Minister for Economic Growth and Jobs, Finance and Government Services, Danny Pearson, was quoted in the Australian Financial Review earlier this year saying, quote, "You put AI on a leash and you let it run. If it starts to get away from you, then you look at trying to say we need to intervene," end quote. So what are some of the regulatory concerns that you have about the growth of data centers in Victoria, considering this quote unquote streamlining?
Well, one major concern is that typically we're not really seeing communities involved that will be impacted, connected with in the process of these buildings being constructed. For example, the Port Melbourne facility didn't need to have any engagement with potential residential communities because of the area that it's being built with. This is not so much the case in a lot of other places in Melbourne that we're seeing data center development, where in, like, let's say West Footscray, where data centers are being built, all of these data centers are right across the road from residential houses. And so there are the general, you know, council meetings, but once data centers are approved, pretty much all contact ceases with the local communities.
Yeah, and if you're pushing through things at the level of ministerial discretion, or there's a minister smoothing the way to have these centers established, then I can imagine that, you know, trying to challenge a decision after the fact is incredibly difficult. Now, talk about the local cost of data centers when it comes to environmental, but also other impacts for communities who might already be living next door to one, or might be living next door to one soon.
Totally. So when we look at contexts like the US, where we've seen a lot more data center development, which the, you know, Australia is trying to emulate, we see significant impacts with not just the costs of water and electricity, but people who are living right next to data centers have significant decreases in water quality or water pressure. Another concern with people who are living right across from data centers is the noise. I mean, all of these computers create a lot of noise, and the things you need to cool them down also produce a lot of noise, which creates like a distinctive hum. And also, a lot of these data centers have hundreds of thousands of liters of diesel on site in case there's ever an outage or they can't access enough electricity from the grid. And so those power the backup generators. And if diesel is being used, that is obviously going to produce a lot of noxious fumes, which people who live right across from these are both concerned about the flammability of these tanks, but also the air pollution that comes with them.
Oh my God, RIP west of Melbourne, that has been like raising concerns about concentrations of chemicals, about explosions on industrial sites, and now data centers with massive diesel reserves are just another aspect of life that people need to be concerned about in their local communities. I'm also thinking about, you know, this heated water and the impacts on things like river systems. You know, when the water itself is heated through the cooling process of the data centers, that also pumps out extremely hot water into the river. Is that not correct?
There's a general heating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a hope, and we see this in some like select areas as like case studies for use of waste heat to potentially warm houses in cooler areas. Mm-hmm. But I think ultimately that requires a lot of planning, which we're not really seeing. So yeah, it's just a kind of a general waste heat which emanates from these places.
Yeah. Now, the cost of data centers obviously extend beyond just the environmental, and your work looks at the ethical impacts of the kinds of capabilities that these centers are enabling. So take us through some of the ethical stakes here.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about data centers today, data centers have existed for a long period of time, like from the birth of the modern internet, but they're increasingly entering mainstream conversation because of the impacts of AI. We're building data centers not just to expand the capacities of the internet, but also because they're what house AI. And the thing about AI as well is that it exacerbates all of these pre-existing issues. The computer components needed to fuel AI get hotter, and they use more energy, and because of that, they need more water, and the buildings are becoming bigger and bigger because of the scale of these operations. And I think talking about those environmental consequences is incredibly important, but I think sometimes they can also distract from what is actually being done in these data centers socially or politically. Like, the problem with AI, I think, is not just that it uses too much energy, or just that it uses water, or that it contributes to air pollution. These are all really important, but also we have to question, do we even want AI in the first place? And do we want Australia to be the hub of AI, the way AI has infiltrated our lives so quickly in every imaginable way? It's not just the economic, it's not just the ecological problems, but it's also the social everyday issues.
Yeah. I mean, it is striking just over the past few years how pervasive the uptake of AI capabilities has been across various sectors and just within our regular lives. You know, for those of us who have an email account or use social media, the constant prompts to use AI tools as part of that, the insertion of AI options, AI assistance in basically all of the software that we use day to day is, yeah, I don't know. For me, I find it creepy, but also I am very much a support of, you know, the contemporary Luddite movement.
Yes. I'm on the same wave, 100%. And I think you have to wonder as well, to what degree the creation of all of these data centers also produces the demands. Like, it's said that they just matching the supply to demand. But really, when you have all of these massive data centers, well, we have to use them. And if we have to use them, then they need to enter every part of your life. And I don't know if that entirely tracks, but that's what we're told.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you think about the way that consumer goods and, you know, like, capitalist world systems have worked for a very long time, we think about, you know, supply and demand as not being so simple as to be like, well, people just want this thing and that's why we have to produce more. There's also the incentivization of people actually wanting things, like the desire to purchase something, the desire to use these things is also something that's actively cultivated. And so, I mean, AI seems a particularly pernicious example of that. Now, how does this question of data centers sit within your research? What is your research focusing on?
So my research is focusing on a lot of the histories of where these data centers are emerging. So I'm interested in the local histories, so places like West Melbourne, and the way that they really trace a lot of earlier infrastructures. Like, on the one hand, they seem incredibly new, but then on the other hand, they seem to reflect, strangely, you know, Australia's kind of agricultural or earlier exports, like wool exports and meat exports. And data centers also have like a similar extractive relationship to the land that it sits on, just like a lot of Australia's earlier industries. And that's why data centers are being really pushed as a key site of investment, because they're considered part of the green transition. You know, Australia's main exports are very extractive, and we are well aware of the environmental consequences. And I think data centers and AI is seen as potentially like a bit of a solution. So instead of exporting coal, which, you know, people increasingly don't want, maybe we can export data instead, which is powered by solar. So it's still like a kind of an export economy, and it's still extractive, if not with coal or gas, then with data, which is systematically stolen from us. Yeah. So like, it's still an export economy and it's still extractive. And that is kind of like pretty typical for Australia.
Yeah. And a big question mark on the use of the word sustainable there, because I think that just requires us to do a little bit more thinking about the less obvious ways that this is generating environmental impacts. I mean, it's pretty easy to see in the case of the traditional extractive industries, the environmental impact. People are quite aware of that. But to think about what sustainability actually means in the context of this kind of infrastructure is a really important thing to do. Now, just before we wrap up, Mitchell, I wanted to ask you about, you know, trends, things that you're noticing as we move into the future, about Australia's voracious appetite to sort of be a home for this industry, and the amount of sort of regulatory catch up that needs to happen. Are people concerned enough?
It's so funny because it really depends on who you ask. Like, a lot of people who oppose these data centers and are skeptical about AI says that the regulation is way too loose. But then when you look at the people who are trying to build them, they're like, wow, the regulation is way too intense. Like, you know, we think copyright is not strong enough. And then the people who want to train AI models on copyrighted information, i.e. stolen information, say, well, you know, Australia's copyright laws are way too restrictive. How can we become the data center or the AI hub of the world if we can't use all of this information freely? So, I mean, I think now is a really early time. You know, a lot of investment is being planned for Australia, but a lot of it hasn't yet been built. And so I think this is a very critical period where we really interrogate what we want as a community that has to live with these things.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Let this interview be a prompt for all of you listening to go find out a bit more about data centers and about, I guess, Australia's turn towards the development of digital capabilities as something that it's marketing itself to the world as being a leader in, because you know, it is so vital that we actually understand what's going on to then be able to challenge things in the way that they need to be challenged, rather than panicking after the fact once everything's in place. Thank you so much, Mitchell. I really, really appreciate your time. And you're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was Mitchell Price, a PhD researcher at Monash University's Emerging Technologies Research Lab. And we were speaking about the growth of the data center industry in Victoria and the potential impacts of this industry in our communities, but also for our ethical environment. Now, Leela, shall we go through what we've been talking about today?
Yes. So first up, we heard from Narita Waite, CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, who spoke to us about how Victoria's tough on crime agenda is exacerbating systemic failures in duty of care to Aboriginal people in custody.
And if you did need to speak to someone about that interview, considering we covered some concerning topics, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, you can call 13YARN on 139276 or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. And then after that, we were joined by Dr. Anita Munoz, the chair of RACGP Victoria, to talk about upcoming changes to the diagnosis and care management of ADHD in Victoria, which will provide greater capabilities to general practitioners and hopefully support equity and more holistic care. And then after that, we heard from Prosper Australia's Executive Director, Raina Fahey, about Victoria's windfall gains tax, which has experienced some public critique from the Property Council of Victoria. But thankfully, Raina was here to help us unpack what that really means.
And after that, we heard an excerpt from last month's Done by Law show, where Human Rights Law Centre Director Sarah Schwartz joined presenters to discuss the findings of the federal court case Brown versus Assistant Commissioner Police, which found that the declaration of the entire Melbourne CBD as a designated zone was unlawful and invalid.
And then, as we just said, finally, you heard from Mitchell Price, Monash University PhD researcher, talking about data centers in Victoria. It's been a very Victoria-heavy episode this week.
Well, you come to us for local news.
Exactly. I mean, next week we'll try and vary it up a little bit. You might hear things even from as far afield as New South Wales. Who knows? But we will catch you next week on Thursday morning breakfast. Until then, take care and we'll speak to you soon.
See you next week.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.